If you want to support this podcast and get a full ad-free episode, sign up to Headstuff Plus.
This show is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Basically. I am your host, Stephanie Preisner, and with me in studio today is Hugh O'Connell, who is a political correspondent with Media Huis, which you may know from the Sunday Independent, the independent.ie and the Independent newspaper. Hugh has been covering politics in this country for how many years now?
Nearly 10 years.
A decade.
And
if a week is a long time in politics, you've seen enough.
A decade is a lifetime.
Well, it is for some people. And the reason I'm doing this episode is because I've had a lot of you asking me, what is the difference between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael? Who are the Green Party? What do Sinn Féin stand for? When you hear something in the media, someone in opposition saying, if we were in government, we would give you free childcare and free healthcare and free houses. How much can that be believed and where does all that money come from? So I've asked you to sit with me and break down each of the major political parties in this country, where they, what they stand for and where they sit sort of socially and economically. If that's not too much to ask you.
Well, we'll give it a go.
Fantasy cabinet. What party would you like to start with?
Well, I suppose we should start with the two political parties that have been the most dominant in the state since its inception. 100 years ago, and that is Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. Mm-hmm. Fianna Fáil has been the dominant party for much of the existence of the state, and I suppose the second most dominant then has been Fine Gael. But these, you know, often the question is asked, is these two parties are in coalition with each other right now, but and it's the first time they've ever been in government with each other, along with the Green Party. But what is the difference between them? And I suppose the difference between them is the manner in which they came to being. And quite simply, Fianna Fáil were on the pro-treaty side. This is the treaty which basically created Northern Ireland and split the island between the six counties of the north and the 26 counties here in the south. So Fine Gael were the pro-treaty side and Fianna Fáil were the anti-treaty side.
So Fianna Fáil wanted 32 counties and...
Yeah, I mean,
that's
at its most kind of basic, I suppose. And bear in mind, these were not parties that existed at the time, but rather supporters of the anti-treaty side came to create Fianna Fáil, and that was led by Eamon de Valera, who founded the party, I think, in 1926. And Fine Gael emerged a little later, an amalgamation of various different political parties, all of whom were broadly seen as pro-treaty.
Is that enough? Like, if you're 18, you've just gotten your first ballot.
I know, right?
Like, do you really care about
no.
the treaty?
I don't think so. I think people, if you're 18, you probably do care about, you know, why are we an island of six and a half million people and we're split into two jurisdictions? I mean, and you know, is there a case to be made for a united Ireland? But you probably don't care about a treaty that was negotiated 100 years ago.
Do you not care more about, like, why you're not going to be able to buy a house or why...
You do. Yeah, of course you do. Yeah, yeah.
So, and so do Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael as a party, so like maybe...
Parties.
As parties, each as a party, do they still stick to that as how they're different? Or are they, now that they're in coalition, are they sort of the same?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the supporters of both parties would argue that politically they're a little different. So Fianna Fáil would consider themselves centre-left and Fine Gael would probably be on the centre-right. Fianna Fáil would be...
Socially or with
well,
money?
Well, so let's break that down a little bit, right? So Fianna Fáil would be considered, I think... I mean, all parties were pretty socially conservative in this state up until quite recently, let's be honest, when you think about the marriage referendum.
Conservative being right.
Yeah, being right, being anti...
Anti-abortion, anti-gay rights.
Anti-women working, for example.
Yes, okay, yeah.
So, you know, pretty conservative. But broadly, I think on the economic side of things, Fianna Fáil would consider themselves centre-left. So they would consider the state having a greater role in things like the provision of housing, for example, that the state would be able to, would be more supportive of people who are not in employment, more supportive of people who need access to healthcare. And Fine Gael would be more centre-right in that they would believe that the market should kind of figure those things out so that the, you know, that they wouldn't necessarily believe in is as big state intervention in housing as Fianna Fáil would, for example.
So the state shouldn't intervene in housing, so you just work and you earn your money.
Mm.
And So let's say, to make it very simple, Fine Gael believe that we should tax people a little bit less so they get to keep more of the money that they
more
earn
money
every
in their
day.
Pocket. Yeah.
And then they get to choose what they spend that on. So if they need to go to a hospital, they can spend it on that. If they want to buy a house, they can spend it on that. Mm-hmm. Whereas Fianna Fáil would be slightly more to the left, thinking, actually, we're going to take a little bit more of money from you, a little bit more tax, and then we'll try to ensure that there are provisions for housing, for health, so that if you don't have a lot of money, it's there for you.
Yeah.
And but there wouldn't be left, like Fianna Fáil aren't as far left as, like they're not very left, are they? They're right in the centre.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I suppose as Fianna Fáil has evolved, it has been, I guess the difficulty with having kind of a left-right debate within Ireland is that, like, Fianna Fáil was the dominant party in the country for most of the last century. I mean, it was in government more often than it wasn't. Even up until 2011, it had been in power for 14 years, and prior to that, it had only been out of power for, I think, 5 years. No, 3 years. And and then it was kind of in government for, the vast, vast majority of the decades before that. So it was the dominant political force. So it tried to then be the party
for everyone.
And when you look at, for example, the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009, one of the reasons why we had that was because Fianna Fáil was far more liberal when it came to the market than they traditionally would have expected to have been. So they let, for example, housing take off, and this major housing bubble, they reduced the tax base. So they basically reduced taxes to such an extent that there was very little tax coming in, and they were reliant on one form of tax, which was stamp duty from the number of new houses being bought and sold. And that created the situation where we had a financial crisis and we needed a big bailout.
Was that kind of so? But you're saying that that's kind of off brand for them, like based on what we've just discussed, of centre left.
It would have been pretty off brand for them. Yeah, it would have been something, I suppose, that they were seen as a party that got into bed with developers, property developers, and that they created the market conditions for developers to flourish. But that, you know, ultimately we built too many houses in the wrong places. And we had a property bubble that couldn't last. It blew up, and we all paid the consequences for that. And we have been paying the consequences. And you and I pay, and our people of our generation pay the consequences.
And
for that.
I mean, in fairness, Fianna Fáil are paying the consequences of that. Was that
Electrated
a party? Do you think that was a party decision, or the decision of? Do you know what I mean? So now Fianna Fáil are tarnished with that brand of like, you caused the housing crisis and you bailed out the banks. Was that the decision of a few, maybe slightly more centre-right members of Fianna Fáil than a party decision of like, let's go this way?
I think it was a decision of the people at the head of that party. Like Bertie Ahern was the dominant political figure. He won 3 elections. He was Taoiseach for 11 years. He was the dominant political figure, and he dictated that policy. And I think there was a variety of reasons for that. One of the primary ones was it was very, very popular. He won 3 elections in a row. And the reason he did that was because his policies were popular.
If we say the Fine Gael are slightly more centre-right, so they, on a small, like they make less social provisions and let the market dictate things, would they have done anything different in that period?
No, I don't think. I mean, if you go back to 2007, the general election manifesto of Fine Gael was even more of a promising more of a giveaway in terms of tax cutting and the provision of, and strangely enough, actually, the provision of more public services like extra guards and extra teachers and so on than Fianna Fáil. It was more kind of expansionary, I suppose, than Fianna Fáil. So that meant that I don't think it would have been any different had, say, Fine Gael. And they could have won that election in 2007. And things might have been a little bit different, but I don't think it would have prevented the sort of collapse that we had in 2008.
So is it fair to say that, because this is kind of what I see from online, which is not always a reliable place, that wealthier people, potentially who own businesses, who earn substantial incomes, are more likely to vote for people like Fine Gael because Fine Gael's policies protect their income and will keep tax lower.
Yes. I mean, if you look at all of the polling data, it would show that people in the kind of ABC1 bracket are more likely to vote for Fine Gael than they are for another political party like Fianna Fáil or Sinn Féin or the Greens, because you're exactly that, because they believe that Fine Gael will keep their taxes lower and will create conditions within the economy that are more beneficial to them than any other political party in the country.
Okay, so then we have Fine Gael, who are slightly more liberal than them, but marginally.
Than Fianna Fáil?
Fianna Fáil, who are more economically, I don't know, generous? Generous, because you're taking money from...
Yeah, they would be, I mean, like Fianna Fáil, as I said, would be more of a sort of would be considered more of a sort of a centre-left party who believe that perhaps people should pay a little bit more tax. But the party did kind of lose the run of themselves a little bit during the run-up to the financial crisis and reduced the tax base to such an extent that, like, we got into major trouble and needed, outside assistance to pay the bills and pay the doctors, the nurses, the teachers. And Fine Gael, I think, broadly, historically, would have believed that the state should be a little bit smaller, that people should pay a little bit tax, that we should have kind of pro-business, pro-enterprise market conditions. But they've kind of changed a little bit on that in recent years. I mean, COVID, for example, changed everything. We spent 40 billion euro on the provision of, social assistance to businesses, to workers, to everyone, to keep the lights on when the country was shut down. They have a leader in Leo Varadkar who's spoken about, we need to just basically maintain health spending that we created during COVID-19, which is not a very traditionally Fine Gael position. Now, he's tacked a little bit away from that now in recent weeks, where he's sort of began speaking a little bit more to that kind of cohort of voters that you identified there, those kind of people in the higher income brackets who maybe have their own business or work in a well-paid job and want to pay a little bit less tax. And he's very much focusing on that message of reducing taxes, whereas Fianna Fáil will be much more talking about we need to spend more on services because there's a shortage of services, there's a shortage of, beds in hospitals, we need to tackle waiting lists, all these kind of things.
But there seems to be a really important piece that doesn't get spoken about. So Fianna Fáil are saying we need more hospital beds, we need more nurses, we need more doctors. Sinn Féin and other opposition parties are saying, you're not doing enough, we need more housing, we need this, we need that. If we were in government, we'd have all of these problems fixed. And no one talks about, well, how, Sinn Féin or other oppositions, how are you going to pay for that?
Yeah.
And other people, like normal citizens, are calling for it as well. Like, I want a house, I want to be able to do these things. But when it comes to taxation, don't understand that, well, that's how we pay for it. Like, you will be giving us more of the money that you earn so that we can spread it among.
So Sinn Féin, for example, and other parties kind of seen more to the left would argue that there is a cohort of people out there who we could tax more, people who earn over 100,000 euro a year, over 150,000 euro a year.
So these people who are voting for Fine Gael because they...
Well, some of them are, certainly. But I mean, I think the electorate has kind of gone a little bit all over the place in the last few elections. I mean, and we can talk about that in a little bit. But yeah, I mean, generally people who would be considered Fine Gael voters, they would be people who we should tax a little bit more. In order to pay for these kind of things. So Sinn Féin believe that if you tax people on higher incomes a little bit more, and you're not and they would argue we're not asking them to pay a huge amount more, and also if we tax kind of assets a little bit more, if we tax people who have a second home, that they should, we'll abolish the property tax, but we'll tax people who own a second home, that would be a way of creating more income to spend more on the provision of services. The counter argument to that is that if you do that, you make the economy less competitive and you get a lot of people maybe potentially leaving the country or just, their businesses become unviable because they're paying too much tax and they have to shut them down. And that contributes to, reducing the tax take overall and potentially putting the economy into trouble. But Sinn Féin would argue that they're asking people just to pay a little bit more so that they can spend more on the provision of services.
But when we look at then, so this is kind of slightly off the point to the description of each of the parties, but when we look to, it doesn't seem to be that money is the problem. Like, for example, the waiting list, the health service, let's just take health. Mm-hmm. We've thrown so much money at health in the last while. Like, I don't think that Sinn Féin or any other party could throw any more money at it and that would be the solution. It doesn't seem to be money. That's
no, I think you're right. But I mean, that is a very good point. So then maybe it comes down to policy choices. But in health, the policy choices are... it's interesting, actually, health policy, because about 5 years ago, all of the political parties came together and they came up with a policy called Sláintecare, which was this idea that we remove private healthcare from the Irish public hospital system and that we have a proper state-funded, state health system. that we don't have half the population reliant on private health insurance, for example. Now, that was agreed to by all of the political parties, but its implementation has been so slow as to be negligible. And there's been kind of huge political rows and rows between, you know, the health minister and his senior civil servants and people in the HSE and all that. And then it's you know, far too complicated to get into now here, I think. But I mean, the net effect of it has been that there has been no real desire to overhaul healthcare in the manner in which was envisaged by Sláinte Care.
No political appetite for it?
No political appetite, no political will. The HSE slow to implement it because they don't believe it's necessarily the right course of action. So all of these kind of log jams creating a situation where still, a large cohort of the population have private health insurance, want to retain their private health insurance. And that's actually, you know, the lack of political will is in part motivated by the fact that a lot of people who vote for the likes of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, they have their private health insurance and they will be loath to give it up because they believe it's a safety net that they need in the event that they get sick. So that has meant that, you know, on health policy, even though all of the parties are agreed that this is the strategy, very few seem interested in implementing it.
Because ultimately, whoever's in power is just thinking about how they can stay in power, and if their voters are not going to be happy about a decision they bring in, they're less likely to do it, which I think is the ultimate flaw of politics.
It's hard to disagree with that. I mean, it's you know, you could argue it's a very cynical way to look at politics, but absolutely. I mean, like the aim of people who get into political life is, you know, they will say that it's to make the country a better place, make the world a better place, and there's a little bit of that. But I mean, you know, there is ambition involved in it as well. I mean,
if
you're putting yourself before the voters and you're saying, I want you to vote for me, and you have to get thousands of people to vote for you, then you have a little bit of a, I want to say an ego, but certainly you have a little bit of personal ambition. And that all, you know, contributes towards, I think, a system in which politicians, they don't like to do things that make them unpopular, for sure, yeah.
Which, yeah, it's just really frustrating when you see, like, objectively, like, we're recording today, temperatures are going to be higher than they've been in 135 years, apparently, in some places.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can, objectively see that there is a climate crisis. Mm-hmm. And yet, some rural TDs know that if they support a ban on burning and cutting turf, they will not get re-elected. So even though it is the right, objectively right thing to do for the planet, their seat is at stake.
They would tell you that is it the right thing to do for the you know, for the rural dweller who needs the turf to heat their home in winter, you know, because they can't get access to a grant to retrofit their home, or they can't afford to retrofit their home to make it warmer into winter.
So I understand, but then you bring logic into it, and it's like, okay, so one person who can't afford this
absolutely
is going to continue.
No, you're
to
right.
Burn.
I mean, look, there's unquestionably the planet is burning; it is on fire. We have a major climate crisis, and there are hard political choices to be made arising out of that. And there is a problem within this government in particular, and we can get into it if you want, with the those hard choices having to be made. Programme for Government is very ambitious in terms of trying to get our overall carbon emissions, I think, more than halved by 2030, I think. But doing that requires hard political choices, like banning the sale.
And I'm not here to criticise
the sale of turf.
I mean, that's one of a number, you know.
Yeah, and that's
Eamon
small,
Ryan is talking today about culling the national herd, but that's a small thing. And I don't like criticising politicians very much because it's a really difficult thing to make these hard decisions. Mm. What does wreck my head is opposition, who don't have to make any hard decisions, whose job it is. And this is the same when Fianna Fáil were in opposition; they were doing the same thing. Whereas, you know, you can tell now that Piers Starty, who is the who's in Sinn Féin, is already probably writing his criticisms of the budget that Pascal Donoghue hasn't even made yet, because that's just his job, is just to criticise.
That's a fair point. One of the things that I always notice about Budget Day is that after the government deliver the budget, the opposition get up and they read from a script.
Yeah, so they haven't
written that in the previous 40 minutes. They might have added little bits and pieces to it, but they are generally reading from a script that would have been written days, weeks, months in advance.
Yeah. So, okay, so we have Fine Gael, they're slightly to the right. Then we have Fianna Fáil, their centre tipping, like, so if you
tipping
imagine
left,
like, yeah, a big cross, they're in the centre, slightly tipping left. Sinn Féin are not near the centre, they're just left, is that correct?
I think that Sinn Féin would see themselves as a left-wing kind of social slightly socialist party, yeah.
And take Sinn Féin out of it.
Foundations would have been in socialism. I think that it's important to say as well about Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, that, and Fianna Fáil in particular, that Sinn Féin and other people in the opposition would say that Fianna Fáil are centre-right, that they're a right-wing party. And
okay.
They'd argue that because of the policies that led to the financial crisis that we talked about earlier.
Right, okay. So we're saying that they're left, but they're probably... But other people would say that they're right.
Yes.
And typically, like, if you take Sinn Féin or any of the titles out of it, what does a left-wing party in general kind of stand for? Like, if we just break it down into left and right-wing politics, what is left?
So broadly, going back to a little bit of what we discussed earlier, they would argue for left-wing policies that would include, you know, higher taxes on people with higher incomes, and the greater provision of state services, more spending on public services. At its most extreme, they would argue that that everything should be nationalised, it should be owned by the people, owned by the state. So, you know, everything from public transport to obviously healthcare, everything,
education, childcare,
all of it.
So it should all be owned by the state, and then the state decides how much it costs. But at the moment, what we have is like private providers of childcare. So then they can set the price, and that's how. Mm-hmm.
Now the state is intervening in that a lot more in recent years. But yeah, I mean, we didn't really do anything about childcare in this country for decades because we thought that women would just look after the children and wouldn't go to work. Or rather, that those were the society in which we existed created those conditions. Therefore, we didn't have any sort of state provision for childcare. So then we, as gradually as women entered the workforce and more and more women came into the workforce and needed people to look after the children, we had all these private providers popping up. So to go back to the Sinn Féin thing, they would say we should have like and Labour as well, who we can talk about, they would argue that we need state-led childcare, state-run childcare.
So both Labour and Sinn Féin are that's economically, like, they're sort of left, tax people and provide services. Socially then, are they left-wing, which would be more liberal?
Yeah, well, the Labour Party would always have been pretty socially liberal, and would have been campaigning. I mean, Labour's current leader, Ivana Batic, was campaigning for abortion, access to abortion in Ireland in the 1980s, 1990s, when it was totally banned here. So that gives you an idea, I think, of how a lot of people in the Labour Party think about those issues. Sinn Féin is a little more different because up until the middle of the 2010s, they would have been a very pro-life party. They would have had, Martin McGuinness, who's the former de facto deputy leader of Sinn Féin, he died 5 years ago, he would have said that Sinn Féin is very much a pro-life party. Now, it has liberalised its position quite considerably, along with other political parties in recent years, because that's where the electorate are. Look at the result of the abortion referendum.
So is that a good, like, because in one way it's, you know, I don't ever think it's great to have a person or an entity have a really calcified view on anything that they will never change their mind. But on another level, it's like, well, if you're just going to go where the wind blows, and I don't mean just Sinn Féin, I mean also Fianna Fáil or whoever's changing their mind about whatever. It's like, well, I don't know how to follow you if I don't know what direction you're going to go, depending on how the wind blows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting perspective. I mean, when it comes to the issue of abortion, I suppose all political parties have liberalised their view in recent years. But Sinn Féin, even Sinn Féin at the moment, that their policy in the north in relation to abortion is slightly different from the south, I think, and it's quite complex, and I couldn't really get into the specifics of it because I'm not massively across it, but certainly, you know, I think that Sinn Féin would be worried about certain socially conservative voters in Northern Ireland fleeing from them, so they feel they have to adopt a position that is slightly more pro-life, anti-abortion than it would be here in the south, where their leader, Mary Lou MacDonald, has always, I think, been on the side of wider access to abortion and has moved the party in that direction. I mean, that is one thing to say, is that she more than anyone, I think, has helped move Sinn Féin to a position of being more pro-choice, pro-abortion. But you're right, there's kind of a political calculation in that as well, because voters, as we saw with the referendum, favour wider access to abortion in this country that we have now.
There is also something to be said for, like, if something passes a referendum, you have to take it like, okay, well, this is the will of the people
now, so
there's no point in us banging the drum.
Absolutely. But Sinn Féin would have campaigned for the passing of that referendum.
Yes, very much so.
I'm going to take a quick break to tell you about our sponsor. Our sponsor is Rockwell Financial, and they have a special offer for Basically listeners. Rockwell Financial protect, but also enhance the wealth of SME owners. If you own a small or medium enterprise, or you are a sole trader in Ireland, Rockwell Wealth Management will protect and enhance your wealth. And they have a free consultation for Basically listeners. So call them up, tell them you're a Basically listener, and they will give you a one-to-one consultation for free. Your heart works 24/7. So if you're worried about chest pain, palpitations or breathlessness, it's really reassuring to know that Expert Heart Care works 24/7 too. The Mater Private Network in Dublin is the only private hospital in Ireland offering urgent cardiac care all day, every day. That's weekends, bank holidays, even through the night. It's a unique service for patients who are worried about their heart and want to be seen quickly by heart experts at one of Ireland's leading hospitals for cardiology care. If you're worried about your heart, remember this number, 1800 247 999. You'll speak directly to a cardiac specialist nurse at Mater Private, and they'll talk to you about your symptoms. And if you need to come to hospital, you'll get a thorough cardiac assessment as soon as you arrive. If you need treatment or a procedure, the cardiology team will work out the most appropriate plan for you. Even if you need treatment the same day, this will be arranged immediately. For urgent cardiac care at Mater Private Network Dublin, call 1800 247 999 or visit materprivate.ie for more information.
For Tech's Sake is a podcast that goes beyond the hype of tech developments to bring listeners the knowledge they need to make informed decisions. And it's hosted by me, Elaine Burke, a science and technology journalist.
And me, Jenny Darmody, editor of Silicon Republic.
Each episode, we're joined by an expert to answer our probing questions to discover what's good tech and what's just tech for tech's sake.
And we've had some amazing guests this season, including roboticist Niamh Donnelly. She was just named Woman of the Year in STEM by Irish Toddler.
We also had Ireland's AI ambassador, Dr. Patricia Scanlon, Stripe CTO David Singleton, and Bobby Healy, CEO of Irish drone company Mana.
And last season, we had Abiba Berhane, who was recently appointed to a UN advisory panel on AI.
We certainly know how to pick them. And if you want to be in the know on tech, robotics, drones, AI, and what have you, on a deeper and more human level, be sure to subscribe.
Can we talk about Sinn Féin outside of the issue of abortion as a party that is in the north and south? Mm-hmm. Because that confuses me sometimes. Because sometimes what they're doing in the north is completely different or is totally the same as what Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens are doing down here. Mm-hmm. And yet in opposition down here, Mary Lou and others are criticising the government for what they are doing. Mm-hmm. But Sinn Féin are doing it in the north. And are they the same party? Is it...
Like, well, they are. But, I mean, they operate within a different political system that, you know, is unique to Northern Ireland. I mean, you had Neil Richmond on here recently, and he was talking about how Northern Ireland and Stormont and the Assembly and the Executive, they're all sort of... You know, they all have to be constituted in a specific way to be representative of the nationalist and the unionist community. And also, you know, Northern Ireland is not a completely independent state. It's, reliant on decisions that are made in Westminster in terms of funding of 10 to 12 billion euro or pounds a year. So they don't have total control over all of this sort of tax collection policies, all that kind of stuff. Healthcare and so on. So that requires Sinn Féin, I suppose, they would argue that they get a lot of decisions forced on them by the Tory government in London, who are, you know, they are very hostile to because of, for historic reasons, and the hunger strikes and Margaret Thatcher and all of that. So that has created a situation, I think, where Sinn Féin feel that they have to adopt certain policies that they wouldn't necessarily adopt in the south. But also, you know, being in government requires tough choices. And they have been in government in Northern Ireland for 20 years on and off. Power sharing has collapsed at various points. But, I mean, since the Good Friday Agreement, they have been in government quite a bit, and it has required them to make difficult decisions that are required when you're in government. And they haven't had that in the south, because in the south, they've really only emerged as a political force in the last kind of 10 years. Prior to that, they were a very small party who weren't electorally successful in the south at all.
What do you think has happened? What has made that change? Mary Lou is a huge part of it.
Mary Lou is part of it, but I think it's more to do with the fact that voters have become increasingly disenfranchised and unhappy with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, the two parties who were the dominant political parties in the state. So for Fianna, but they got very upset with Fianna Fáil for good reason after the financial crisis and the 2011 election, where Fianna Fáil went from 70 plus seats down to 20. And they equally have grown unhappy with Fine Gael because they believe that Fine Gael just adopted the Fianna Fáil policy of austerity and that they've done nothing to solve the housing crisis in 10 years. So you've seen Fianna Fáil go from a position of 77 seats in the 2011 election down to 35 in the last general election in 2020. So that gives you an indication of voters no longer putting their faith in the political powerhouses of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, and instead they want to something different.
So is it and like anyone but?
And it then is, yes.
If Sinn Féin stepped in there?
There's polling data which shows that when voters are asked, why do you support Sinn Féin, I think it's 49% say because they're not Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael.
Wow.
Which is pretty astonishing, right? Because...
But there are also people before, like there are other parties that
there
could
are,
be
filling
that.
There are, but I mean, Sinn Féin, I suppose, project themselves as a political force and a political alternative to voters that in a more compelling manner than the other political parties, like Labour, and we can talk about the reasons why Labour are where they are, but they project themselves as an alternative. They have people like Eoin Óibrin, who says he'll fix the housing crisis and he'll help people get a home, you know, and he'll fix the rental crisis and so on and so forth.
But they don't...
Bright, articulate spokespeople who don't have an association with the IRA and all the bad things that Sinn Féin and the IRA were involved in, and people who, I suppose, espouse an alternative that voters find very compelling. But crucially, they're not Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, and they're not a political party that have broken promises, whereas Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have a multitude of promises broken in the
There's
the eyes
definitely
of the
a sense of like, well, sure, look, give them a chance, it couldn't be worse.
Well, that is also a thing, right? I mean, they've never been in government in the south of Ireland, so why shouldn't they be given a chance to see how they could run the country? And they say they're preparing for government, and there's, you know, even after the last election, there was a hashtag Mary Lou for Taoiseach. You know, there's a feeling amongst people who vote for Sinn Féin and people who support Sinn Féin that they should be given a chance to try and fix a crisis that, I mean, particularly with housing, which has all sorts of secondary effects across society, you know, that they should be given a chance to fix it, because what Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have been doing for the last 10 years hasn't
just
worked.
It's not working. And so when we talk about earlier on, like, if you're 18, do you really care about the treaty and do you really care about Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and Michael Collins and Eamon de Valera?
Mm.
If you're 18, do you care about the IRA? Do you care about pre-Good Friday Agreement? How much should you care about that? And
well, I would argue you should care about that. You should care about history, should care about where political parties come from, where politicians come from, their background, their beliefs, their core beliefs. But it's not unreasonable for voters not to care about that. I mean, the Good Friday Agreement is 25 years old next year.
But at its most brittle since its inception.
Yes,
but that's because of Boris Johnson's government.
Yeah, but I mean, it's brittle and you know, politically it's difficult, but people aren't blowing each other up to the extent to which they were.
They are burning effigies of Michelle O'Neill.
No, that's true. Yeah, there's a lot of hate
There's a lot of hate.
There's a lot of hate. But the sort of violence that, you know, I would have kind of very vaguely remembered seeing growing up as a child on the news.
That's not there.
It's not there, no. And so in those circumstances, and there's a whole generation of people who've grown up in Northern Ireland at peace, basically, more or less. And there's a lot to be said for that. And, you know, there's a lot to be said for the fact that Sinn Féin played a key role in bringing that about. And Gerry Adams, the former leader of Sinn Féin, Mary Lou's predecessor, he helped deliver that by, I suppose, convincing the armed wing of Sinn Féin, the IRA, who committed the most appalling atrocities for 20, 30 years in Northern Ireland and the South and on mainland UK, that he helped bring that violence to an end. He helped bring the more militant element of the Republican movement to heal and to a situation where they bought into the peace process. So, you know, I think that the issue that some of Sinn Féin's opponents would have was the extent to which they tried to justify those atrocities, and they believed that it was in the cause of a war, whereas the reality is slightly different. There wasn't widespread support for the IRA's campaign. There was support amongst a significant cohort of people, but there wasn't popular support for it. And you know, they argue they were engaged in a legitimate war. A lot of other people would see it as a violent campaign of terrorism.
So when we know what Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are like in government, mm-hmm. we've seen it. Mm-hmm. Have Sinn Féin been explicit, apart from just being positioning themselves as the antithesis of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, mm-hmm. and just vote for somebody else that isn't them? Have they been explicit about what their government would look like, why people should vote for them in a meaningful way, in terms of, you know, if you have concerns about the IRA, about like what they do in justice, or what they, apart from like, we will build houses, have they given a more robust...
On housing, certainly, and we won't fixate on housing, but they certainly have offered an alternative in terms of greater state involvement in the provision of social housing, affordable housing, things like a rent freeze for 3 years, a tax relief that would give a person back 1 month's rent, or tax credit, I think it is. But in other areas, no, I couldn't really tell you what Sinn Féin's justice policy is. I mean, I haven't, you know, I'm aware of their policies broadly, I mean, I haven't gone in depth into their justice policy. But I mean, nothing on the face of it, nothing strikes me as particularly revelatory about their justice policy. I think that any party that might go into government with Sinn Féin might have concerns about them going into the Department of Justice because, for example, they don't believe, or that they have abstained and until recently opposed legislation which underpins the Special Criminal Court, which is a non-jury court, which has been criticised by some human rights organisations, but has also been responsible for convicting some of the most dangerous criminals that have ever existed in this country, and has played a very important role in tackling that sort of really vicious, horrendous crime that has devastated communities across the country. But, you know, one thing I think that Sinn Féin hasn't been scrutinised on, but will be scrutinised on, is their climate policy. They're against the carbon tax. Just recently...
But can you be against the carbon tax when it's kind of coming from Europe, isn't it? Like,
I'm not sure. I don't think...
Like, we have a European mandate to meet these criteria.
There is a European mandate to meet these criteria, but it doesn't necessarily specify the extent, the way to which you go about it.
Okay. Now,
you can be against carbon tax. I mean, some Green Party people are against carbon tax because they believe it harms poorer households who could, you know, can ill afford to meet the costs, and believe there are more, I suppose, socially progressive ways of tackling...
Okay.
Fossil fuel emissions. But if you take, for example, the global commitment to more than halve our carbon emissions by 2030, within that there are sectoral emissions ceilings, and these are basically the each sector of the economy, so agriculture, transport, health, and so on, all have to commit to reducing their carbon emissions by a certain amount in the next 10 years. Less than 10 years, in fact. Now, there's a global commitment to 51%, an overall commitment to 50%, and within that there are different sectors that have to commit to take agriculture, for example, has to commit to either between 22% and 30% reduction in emissions over the next eight years or so. And people in the Green Party side think it should be at the higher end, 30%, and people on the agriculture side think it should be 22%. Sinn Féin don't have a position. And they argue we don't have a position on that because we haven't seen all of the data, so we can't come to a position on that. But surely if you're a policy or a party that is espousing, I suppose, greater reduction in emissions to meet that target, you should have a policy, right? You should have a policy how you're going to get there. And so Sinn Féin's climate policy, even take, for example, a recent no-confidence motion in the government where Mary Lou MacDonald and Sinn Féin politicians stood up and heavily criticised the government for its, you know, failures over the last 2 years, didn't mention climate policy once.
Because they know that you can come back and be like, you don't even have one.
Yes. Well, they would argue they do have a climate policy, but I don't think it's a climate policy that's particularly well thought out or seems to have... They don't, to my mind, they haven't put in the amount of work into their climate policy as they have into their housing policy.
Is that because they know that, like, more people care about housing?
Yeah. I mean, look at all of the... There's a succession of opinion polls. The public's concern for the climate crisis is not great, I don't think.
Well, it might be great tonight.
It might be great tonight when they can't sleep. It might be great in winter when they're freezing and they can't afford to pay their bills, but... You know, at the moment, I think people might say they're concerned about climate change, but they might not necessarily want to vote for parties who say that you've got to really change the way you go about your life.
And that's the crux of the problem. So we've done Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Sinn Féin. Do you want to touch on the Greens and Labour?
So the Labour Party is actually the... I mean, Sinn Féin might claim they're the oldest political party in the state because they were founded in 1905 by Arthur Griffith, but they split in the 1970s. So the Sinn Féin that exists today is the Sinn Féin that kind of emerged out of the split in 1970. And that was to do with an abstentionist policy that Sinn Féin had adopted that they wanted... Some of the party wanted to get rid of. Abstaining from, the Parliament in Northern Ireland and from the Dáil and from the Parliament in Westminster. But the Labour Party, founded in 1912 by James Connolly and others, and has for decades, I suppose, been involved in, I think it's been involved in about 8 different governments, and it's usually been as a coalition partner to Fine Gael, most recently between 2011 and 2016. And it was always a party that argued for much greater state intervention in the provision of public services, greater social welfare rates, greater access to healthcare, and I suppose again was very big on the socially liberal agenda. Removing.
Why are they called Labour? Was it about workers' rights or unions?
Yeah, they were linked to the trade union movement, okay. And they are still linked to the trade union. They're kind of the official political party of the sort of mainstream trade union movement within Ireland. So they would have close links to SIPTU, for example, and all those big trade unions in the country who would in part fund them as well. And I think that, they're, as I said, they're a party that has really made their name on being more socially progressive than any of the other political parties. And
so
they've always
brought
a kind of a socially progressive element to a government that they're in coalition with. So,
which can't be undermined because, it's useful for, this is showing my opinion, but for a socially liberal party. If they're in coalition with someone who's not so liberal on the right, that if in a coalition they kind of drag them more to centre, so no one
Absolutely.
Is getting too extreme.
No, they do. And one of the great frustrations of people who people in the Labour Party is that they tend to drag Fine Gael to the centre or to the left or to more socially liberal positions, and then Fine Gael go off and take all the credit for it. Right.
So. Right. Okay.
So take, for example, marriage equality in 2015, that referendum.
Where Leo Varadkar became the face of it.
Yeah, you could argue that for sure, yeah.
But that would have been fueled more by the Labour Party in the early
stages.
Well,
the Labour Party would have ensured that referendum took place. I mean, I always remember that the Labour leader at the time was Eamon Gilmore, and he said a year or two in advance of that referendum that it was the civil rights issue of a generation, marriage equality, that gay people would be able to marry. And Enda Kenny was asked about that later, and Eamon Gilmore, who he was in coalition with, saw, and Enda Kenny was a Taoiseach, that it was actually I put it to him. I said that Eamon Gilmore has said that this is the civil rights issue of the generation. Do you believe it is? And he didn't. He said housing or something like that was one of the big issues of this generation, which is fair enough. It's a point of view. But then, within a year, he was totally on board with the idea of marriage equality, having been against it before. His party had been against it before. Even Leo Varadkar had been against gay marriage. Leo Varadkar had been strongly anti-abortion, for example. And again, the Labour Party would have played a role in moving Fine Gael to a position of gradually liberalising abortion law in Ireland and then kind of setting the stage for the referendum in 2018. Labour would have been opposed to the Eighth Amendment referendum in 1983, very strongly opposed to it. They've had very strong liberal voices through the generations, people like Michael D. Higgins, the current president.
He's
Labour, he was a Labour minister, he was a Labour TD for many years. Mary Robinson, former president, also member, a former long-time Labour senator. So people who've been, at the forefront of major social changes in Ireland have generally had some cause or link to the Labour movement, to the Labour Party. But Labour has become a shadow of its former self.
Yeah, where are those voters who are those sort of, where are they moving to?
I mean, the Labour Party's collapse goes back to kind of 2010, 2011, where it emerged as a strong political force because it was an alternative to Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. And Fianna Fáil were on their way out of office because they were in government and had been for 14 years and we were in the midst of a financial crisis and they were seen as the cause of it. And Fine Gael were on the rise, but, a lot of voters weren't sure about Fine Gael, so they kind of, expressed a preference for the Labour Party. And there was even this idea that Eamon Gilmore, who was the Labour leader at the time, could become Taoiseach. There was these posters, Eamon Gilmore for Taoiseach. And in the run-up to the 2011 general election and in the final weeks of the campaign, there were polls that indicated that Fine Gael could win an overall majority. So that would mean that Fine Gael could go into government without any need for a coalition partner. So the Labour Party produced a poster, and it was based on the Tesco Every Little Helps ad. And it was all of these things that they said that Fine Gael would introduce if they were in government on their own, things like water charges. They would put up the price of a bottle of wine. So they're kind of appealing to sort of middle class voters who might like a bottle of wine and don't want the cost of it to go up. And that poster ended up becoming kind of a noose around its neck because it was all of the things in the poster were pretty much implemented by the government that they formed with Fine Gael subsequently over the following 5 years.
So following that poster, they then went into coalition with Fine Gael and did all the Tesco things that they said they wouldn't.
Yes.
Right, okay.
So if ever there was in my time covering politics, there's never been a more vivid example of a broken promise, a series of broken promises. And Labour won 37 seats in 2011 and they won 7 in 2016.
Oh, wow.
So that gives you an indication of the degree to which the voters took out their wrath on the Labour Party, and they haven't recovered since then. They've been through a succession of leadership changes. In 2020, they won, I think, 6 or 7 seats, so they haven't really recovered from that period. And there's now really fundamental questions about whether the party can survive and whether it can remain relevant when it's kind of been completely squeezed on the left. I mean, Sinn Féin is now the dominant opposition party. And Labour is kind of fighting for relevance with another party, which we can talk about if you want, the Social Democrats, who are made up primarily, and Social Democrats were only formed 7 years ago, but they're made up primarily of disaffected former members of the Labour Party.
Okay.
So the Social Democrats' co-leaders are Catherine Murphy and Roisin Shorthall, both former members of the Labour Party. Roisin Shorthall was in the Labour Party up until about 10 years ago.
And is that sort of a quick, we need to pivot because our brand is so damaged? Or do they fundamentally disagree with something that...
You mean Catherine Murphy and Roisin Shorthall?
Yes. Or,
yeah, each of them would have left...
Stephen Donnelly
was also involved with that party, yeah.
Right,
so.
Okay.
Catherine Murphy would have left the Labour Party many years ago over a kind of a historic split more than anything, and I think it was a personality difference. Roisin Shorthall left the Labour Party in 2012 because she disagreed with some of the things that Fine Gael were doing in the Department of Health, where she was a junior minister at the time, and she quit the Labour Party. And so she came together with Catherine and Stephen Donnelly, who was an independent TD at the time, to form the Social Democrats in 2015. And this was a party that was, as the name suggests, a social democratic party that argued, again, for greater state intervention and, in particular, very, very strong on things like healthcare. Roisin Shorthall would have chaired that committee that agreed the Sláinte care reforms 5 years ago. They would have argued for a real state intervention in childcare and so on and so forth, and just the real focus away from potentially cutting taxes into just greater provision of public services, and a real kind of social democratic state built on sort of the idea of what we have in Sweden and Denmark, for example, where people get really great services, but they pay a little bit more tax.
But are, in that sense, like, are all of the left parties not social democrats? Like, are they not?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Labour would argue they're a social democratic party as well. But it's the degree to which you believe...
Which that's the forefront of, that's your thing.
What's the forefront of your thinking? I mean, I don't say... So the Social Democrats, for example, I don't think they would be as big on social issues. Like, say, for example, an issue at the moment like trans rights. Social Democrats wouldn't really have a strong policy on that, whereas the Labour Party perhaps would.
Right, okay. They wouldn't have a strong policy on it either way. Just sort of like, we're not going to interfere in that.
I interviewed Catherine Murphy and Roisin Shorthall recently, and they just didn't seem to have a particularly strong position on the issue, whereas some people within the party believe that Social Democrats should be much more to the forefront of that debate, if you want to call it a debate. You know, some people argue it shouldn't be a debate, but nonetheless, it is an issue. It is an issue as to, you know, the extent to which government should be involved in those matters, and I suppose some people think the Social Democrats should have a stronger position on that. Some of their their members think that.
Can I ask a more broad question that's kind of touching on that? So does a party need to have a position on, so say Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, very broad parties, they have seats of, like, in very many constituencies, is made up of, you know, people of both of all genders and of all age groups. How difficult is it? Like, so it's easy for maybe the Labour Party with six seats to take a very clear stance on, like, this is our united opinion on this trans issue. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're in one of the bigger parties, how important is it to have a party line on, like, this is how we feel about abortion? Or if you don't, like, let's say, you know, with Fianna Fáil during the abortion referendum, very many of their politicians were coming out saying, I'm absolutely against this. But then others were saying, I'm absolutely pro this. So as a party, the message kind of gets diluted and you kind of don't know how, like, how important is it for a party to have a party line on something? For the electorate?
For the electorate, I think it's important, yeah. But I think perhaps the electorate has matured a little bit on that issue, that they don't believe that parties should stick should so rigidly enforce what's known as the whip, on which is basically the party line on an issue and which way a party should vote on an issue, and that everyone in that party should vote that way. I think you've seen that that has been loosened a little bit over the last years, and so particularly, as you said, you know, kind of abortion, where Fianna Fáil, there were some members who were against the referendum passing and some members who were very, very much for it. But I think for voters, yeah, they like to know what they're, if they're voting for a political party, they like to know what they stand for. But the Irish electorate, and I suppose the Irish political system, is different in a way in that we have a very strong connection to our local TD, because constituencies are reasonably small, are small by kind of international standards. You look at the UK, for example, I think there's one MP per 60,000 of the population. Constitutionally, in Ireland, it has to be one TD per 30,000 of the population. You have constituencies where there are 3, 4, 5 TDs from different political parties, and people have a connection to their TD. They would engage with their TD when they need them for a passport, for example, or when they need to get a jump up a waiting list or whatever, or when they're trying to get a medical card or things like that. And I think that sort of connection with their TD means that they like to know where their TD stands on a particular issue, and they wouldn't necessarily vote for the political party without knowing who the TD in their area is. Now, that changed a little bit in 2020, where people just voted for Sinn Féin because they wanted to vote for Sinn Féin. They didn't even know who the candidate was in their constituency. We had all sorts of mad stories about Sinn Féin candidates who, I think, 4 of Sinn Féin's current TDs, or at least 3 anyway, had lost their council seats in 2019. They weren't particularly strong politicians, but because of the Sinn Féin brand in 2020, they topped the poll.
There was that sense that, like, anyone could have run.
Yeah, you
like, a couple of them didn't even do campaign. I know a woman in
Kildare, Patricia Ryan, was on holiday during the campaign. Holidays. Yeah, she'd booked a holiday before the election, and before the election was called, and she went ahead and went on her holiday, and she still topped the poll. But historically, Irish people have been very connected to their local TD, and I think that they like to know where they stand on a particular issue. And I don't think they necessarily, you know, but of course, when you're voting for a political party, you like to know where they stand on a particular issue. And parties take a different position depending on the issue as to the extent to which they'll punish their TDs for voting against the party position. So some TDs will be banished from the party entirely forever. That happened to a couple of Fine Gael TDs when they voted against abortion legislation in 2013. But the Green Party, for example, 2 of their TDs recently voted against a government's motion on the National Maternity Hospital and the new National Maternity Hospital, and they've been suspended for 6 months, and they're expected to return to the Green Party within a few weeks.
On the Green Party, just because for me, the Green Party are just like agricultural and carbon issues, you know? Do they have, outside of that, a kind of a broad brand of, you know, economic and social policy?
Yeah, I mean, I think their economic and social policy would be tied to the climate issue, you know? So they believe, for example, that the, you know, there's different factions within the Green Party who believe slightly different things. So there's some people in the Green Party who, you know, don't think the carbon tax is and increases in the carbon tax is the best way to go about achieving climate action. But, you know, the Green Party position, the formal position, is that the carbon tax and the increases that are coming into effect over successive budgets in the next few years, that that should go towards the provision of retrofitting, and that it should go towards, say, the fuel allowance, for example, to help households that most need support to pay their fuel bills in winter. And they're quite socially liberal as well. So Roderick O'Gorman, who's the Children and Equality Minister, he would have been, he's a long-time member of the Green Party. In fact, he joined the Green Party when he was 10. Well, he canvassed for the Green Party when he was 10, and he joined, I think, when he was in college. But he would have been responsible, I think, for driving that sort of socially liberal agenda within the Green Party that kind of ensured that it wasn't just a party about...
Recycling.
Right. And so, for example, when the Greens were last in government in 2007, between 2007 and 2011, with Fianna Fáil, it was a government that kind of ended disastrously because of what happened to the country. But they would have, the Greens would have pushed for civil partnership legislation, which was kind of the precursor to same-sex marriage. So they would have pushed that kind of socially liberal agenda within the party. And in general, I think the Greens would believe in sort of creating a taxation system that essentially punishes people who emit more carbon. So, you know, higher motor tax on cars that have higher emissions, carbon tax on fossil fuels that obviously have very high emissions, and I suppose incentivizing people to use lower emitting forms of transport. So, for example, there's been a reduction in public transport fares across the country, and that's a Green Party policy that they've driven with a view to try and get more people out of their car and onto buses and trains and trams.
It is interesting, though, isn't it, that like when you're in coalition, it's easier for the larger parties to take credit for those wins.
Well, that's the thing, and I find even my day-to-day work, you often get people in the Green Party kind of saying to me, you know, make sure that you mention us as having been a strong proponent of that policy.
Because
I mean, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil will happily claim credit for the reduction in public transport fares, because I think it's been a very popular policy. But it's been driven by the Green Party. The Green Party, Eamon Ryan, their leader, is the transport minister. So he's driven that agenda. But other parties like to take credit for that. And you always find that in coalition governments. And I think you'll find that the most popular Green Party policies, and Roderick O'Gorman, who I mentioned, is the children's minister, and he's pledging to cut the cost of childcare over the next 2 years in half. You'll find that Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil will want to claim credit for that as well.
Before I let you go, I know there are other parties that we should talk about. Which ones do you want to mention? I also want to ask you, do we have any far-right parties in this country, and how are they doing?
They exist on paper. I think there's the National Party. There are some far-right parties that have kind of emerged onto ballot papers over the years, but they haven't gone anywhere. And I think it's one of the great things, I think, about Ireland is that we haven't had that sort of the creation of a sort of element. You know, there are always people within a society who do believe that, for example, we shouldn't have the immigration policy that we have. So
we shouldn't let people in.
Ireland is for Irish people. There's always going to be people who believe that, but there doesn't seem to be any political movement that has emerged that in any way
is taking hold,
even winning a Dáil seat or anything like that. And I think that's a great strength of Ireland, really, that we are prepared to have a very open door. I mean, look at the Ukrainian refugee crisis. We've had 42,000 refugees arrive since February, and we have opened our doors to them, in a very generous way, I think. And now there's all sorts of questions and issues around the provision of accommodation, whether the state's doing enough on that front. But there isn't really any far-right political parties in Ireland that are worth talking about. There are, on the left, there are People for Profit, and there are the left-wing independent TDs. I suppose one political force that we should talk about is the independent, because there are a number of independent. There's well over a dozen independent TDs in the current Dáil, and there were I think at one stage in recent years there were about 25-30 independent TDs, and I think that's a strong political brand that exists within Ireland that we should probably spend a little bit of time talking about before we finish up. The independent TD, I suppose, is someone who is locked into their constituency, is motivated solely by constituency issues. They talk about national issues that are most relevant to their constituents. And I suppose the most, the strongest political brand there is the Healy Rays in Kerry, right? So Michael Healy Ray was the sort of the father figure of that
empire.
Yeah, he was Fianna Fáil gene pool. He tried to run for the party in 1997, and he was thwarted. He was a long-serving member of Fianna Fáil in Kerry, and he was thwarted in his attempt to run for the party in the 97 general election. So he ran as an independent and he topped the poll. And a succession of Healy Rays have topped the poll in Kerry ever since then. And that is primarily because they are solely focused on constituency matters and delivering for the people of Kerry. So Michael Healy Ray would have, or Jackie Healy Ray rather, would have delivered a huge amount for the people of Kerry in terms of he would have negotiated deals with the Fianna Fáil government at the time that would have ensured millions ploughing into the constituency, improvements in roads, improvements in services, improvements in hospitals, all these kinds of things that benefited the people of Kerry. So that kind of strong political brand, constituency focused, and you've seen that replicated in other constituencies where there are independentees who frequently do very well because they're very focused on delivering for their constituents in a way that I suppose they don't have to focus too much on national issues because they're not a member of a political party. They're not required to go out and bat for that political party. They can just focus on their constituents.
Is there not a sort of an impotence, though? Like, obviously the Healy Rays are not impotent. They get so much done. But why would you choose to be an independent? Like, you're always going to be in opposition.
Not true, though.
Not true.
No,
okay.
Well, I mean, yes, primarily. But if you take the last government before this one, there was a Fine Gael minority government with independents. And there was a number of independent TDs who served the cabinet. Shane Ross, Finian McGrath.
Yeah.
And he had junior ministers like John Halligan and Sean Canny and Kevin Boxer-Moran. And again, these were independent TDs who, you know, Shane Ross was the Minister for Transport. And we can debate how effective he was. But, I mean, certainly, you know, he would have ensured that some of his constituency issues were dealt with as part of the programme for government, most notoriously and famously the step-aside Garda station, which had been closed in 2011, that getting that reopened again in his constituency was very important matter for him, and he ensured it got done. So,
but he didn't get a seat then?
He did, you're right, he lost his seat, yeah. So it swings and roundabouts, and, you know, Finian McGrath, the other member of the cabinet there, he didn't run in the last election. He retired, and you know his seat probably would have been in doubt. But you know, take Catherine Zappone, for example, another independent TD. She was part of that government, and she negotiated into that programme for government a commitment to set up a citizens' assembly to consider the issue of the Eighth Amendment and abortion rights, and that precipitated the referendum on that in 2018. So independent TDs have found a way to operate within government that both benefits, nationally, but also benefits for their own constituency as well. But obviously, yeah, they don't always keep their seat because being in government requires hard choices sometimes, and the voters aren't always prepared to reward TDs for that.
Well, I think that's a brief 101 of of the political. Have we missed?
Well,
I mean, we have.
We've missed a few. I mean, I mentioned People for Profit briefly. They're a very far left party who argue strongly in favour of
socialism,
effectively, that the state would own everything. The state would own the banks. You know, we'd tax millionaires, and I suppose we would. Much greater free public transport is one of their policies, actually, which I think is a very interesting policy. And again.
But like you're taxing millionaires. That's fine. Mm. I mean,
there's a question to be asked about how realistic their policies would be and how deliverable they would be, given that history tells us that socialism in its purest form hasn't really worked
ever.
But certainly, I think that there is a lot to be said for some of the policies they espouse. Not least, I think free public transport is one of those policies that I think it merits consideration in circumstances where you're trying to get people out of their cars and onto forms of public transport.
I don't think anyone is not choosing public transport because of the cost of it. I think people just don't want, like, if it's free, it's also going to be more busy.
That's true. Busier. But then you just do more of it, right?
Yeah, but like, we don't even have, like, do we have enough Lewis's? Remember when the two Lewis's didn't connect?
Yeah, true enough. So that's a kind of a brief rundown, I think, of all of the political parties.
Thank you so much for that. People will listen to this and then I'm sure they'll have follow-up questions which I can ask. Maybe we'll do something else closer to the election. Can I ask, do you think that we'll get to the next general election?
As in, will we get one soon?
No, as in, do you think this government will make it for the next 2.5 years?
I do, yeah, I do. I think it will make it because I don't see that there is... I don't think any of the three parties within the government wants a general election anytime soon. I think their Dáil majority is bigger than it is when it's stripped back to its barest form, where they do appear to be in the minority, but they do have a lot of support from independents and people who are temporarily outside of the government parties because they voted against them. So I think this government will last the full run, and there'll be an election in late 24 or early 2025. But I could be wrong.
A week is a long time in politics.
A week is a long time in politics, exactly.
Thank you so very much. That is Hugh O'Connell, political correspondent for The Sunday Independent, The Independent, Independent.ie, and Media Huis in general. That is another episode of Basically. Our music is by Only Ruin. Our graphic design is by Cathal O'Gara. And we are part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network. See you next week.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Head Stuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.
If you want to support this podcast and get a full ad-free episode, sign up to Head Stuff Plus.